the year, recreating notable events of passing time, reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. ...1919, that was the year. January 5, Oyster Bay, New York. In the big gable house known as Sagamore Hill, about 11 p.m.
How you all feeling, Mr. Colonel?
Fine, Jim. A little tired.
Maybe better rest a spell, Colonel.
Yes, maybe I had. Hey, Jim, turn out the light. I'm in for a bit of sleep.
Yes. I'll be right in the next room, sir.
All right, Jim. Good night.
Good night, Mr. Colonel.
The next morning, a shocked world read this bulletin, signed by three physicians.
Colonel Roosevelt retired about 11 o'clock. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, his man, who occupied an adjoining room, noticed that while the colonel was sleeping quietly, he was breathing hard. He died almost immediately without waking from what seemed to be a natural sleep. The cause of death was an embolus.
2 days later, Theodore Roosevelt, 26th president of the U.S., was laid to rest in the Oyster Bay Cemetery. Among the mourners were two allies in the colonel's hectic career, William Howard Taft and General Leonard Wood.
1919. That was the year.
The U.S. Senate Chambers, January 16.
Mr. President!
The chair recognizes the gentleman from Texas, Senator Shepard.
I have the honor to announce that this morning, Nebraska ratified the Prohibition Amendment, making the 36th state to ratify it. Within less than 13 months, the amendment becomes part of the federal constitution. The shortest time within which any amendment has been ratified, with the sole exception of the amendment abolishing slavery.
January 25, 1919, Versailles, France.
On the eighth day of the peace conference, planned to end the war to end all wars, a resolution to create a League of Nations has been adopted, and President Woodrow Wilson of the United States of America has been named chairman.
In accepting this post, said President Wilson,
in coming into this war, the United States never for a moment thought that she was intervening in the politics of Europe, or the politics of Asia, or the politics of any part of the world. The thought was that all the world had now become conscious that there was a single case of justice and liberty for men of every kind and place. Therefore, the United States should feel that its part in this war should be played in vain if there ensued upon it abortive European settlements. It would feel that it could not take part in guaranteeing those European settlements unless that guarantee involved the continuous superintendence of the peace of the world by the Associated Nations of the world.
3 days later found the delegates to the peace conference at odds as to the disposal of certain German colonies. But on June 28th, the Treaty of Peace with Germany was finally signed. Some of the more pertinent terms were,
Germany restores Alsace-Lorraine to France.
Germany accepts the internationalization of the Saar Basin for 15 years and of Danzig permanently.
Germany cedes certain territory to Belgium, Poland, and other allied and associated powers.
Germany renounces all territorial and political rights outside Europe, pertaining to either her own or her allies' territories.
Germany reduces her army within 3 months to 200,000 men, with reductions determined by the Allies every 3 months thereafter, reaching a minimum of 100,000 by March 31, 1920.
Germany abolishes conscription within her boundaries.
Germany accepts full responsibility for all damages caused to Allied and Associated governments and nationals.
On June 29, President Wilson sailed from France, headed homeward, convinced he had played no small part in saving democracy for the world.
1919. That was the year.
Friday, February 21, Bunker Hill, Oswego, New York.
Dr. Mary Walker, the eccentric 87-year-old physician, famous as the only woman granted the right by law to wear male attire, belligerent lobbyist in Congress for rights for women, journalist, inventor of the inside neckband on men's shirts, died from injuries suffered in a fall 2 years ago.
June 15, 1919.
The lazy drone of insects fills a sun-drenched air over a peat bog back of the white chalk cliffs of Clifton, Ireland. No living man is within sight. Suddenly, from the west appears an infinitesimal black speck in the sky. A new drone, ominous, never before heard by the denizens of this Irish marsh. Send swamp lizards and dragonflies scurrying. The speck grows until it looks like a huge insect itself. At last...
Here we are.
Yeah. But where are we?
Well, I don't know quite. But at least it's land.
Is it? Looks like a cranberry marsh to me.
Well, as a matter of fact, it might be Ireland.
Yeah. Might be the Sahara Desert.
Well, come along, Art. Let's look the machine over.
Two days later, London, England.
Captain John Alcock and your American navigator, Lieutenant Arthur W. Brown, I take extreme pleasure, in behalf of the London Daily Mail, in presenting you with the award of £10,000 offered by this newspaper for the first non-stop transatlantic flight in an aeroplane.
Captain Alcock grimly remarked,
"We had a terrible journey, and the wonder is that we are here at all. The fog was very dense, and at times we had to descend within 300 feet of the sea. For 4 hours, our machine was covered by a sheet of ice. At another time, the fog was so dense that our speed indicator did not work, and for a few minutes, it was very alarming. We looped the loop, I do believe, and did a very steep spiral. We did some very comic stunts, for I had no sense of horizon."
Thus did an unnamed British Vickers Vimy plane, carrying English John Alcock and American Arthur Brown to success and reward. But Alcock's enjoyment of his fame was to be short-lived. On December 18 of the same year, he died from injuries received when his plane crashed near Courlevrain, Normandy.
1919. That was the year
that citizens of the U.S. who had never left home shores saw for the first time the awe-inspiring sight of a dirigible floating over their heads to land serenely at Mineola, New York. This was the British R-34. Manned by a crew of 31, she took but 7 days to make the crossing from Scotland to America.
That was the year
that three American naval seaplanes, the NC-1, NC-3, and NC-4, under the command of Lieutenant Commander A.C. Reed, and each manned by a crew of 5, started their historic flight from the U.S. to Lisbon, Portugal. Only the NC-4 landed on European ground at Plymouth, England, after a trip consuming 57 hours, 16 minutes. 1919. An historic milestone in the history of aerial navigation.
1919, that was the year
that philanthropist retired steel magnate Andrew Carnegie died, leaving an estate valued at more than $23 million.
That was the year.
Monday, December 1st, the former Nancy Langhorne, Belle of Mirador, Virginia, USA, takes her seat in the British House of Commons, flanked by Prime Minister David Lloyd George and Arthur James Balfour. Representing Plymouth, she is now the Viscountess Nancy Witcher Astor, the first woman to take her seat as a member of the House of Commons.
1919. That was the year
that Henry Ford sued the Chicago Tribune for $1 million, basing his claim for damages upon the editorial comment that Mr. Ford was an anarchist. Consuming 4 months and producing 2 million words of testimony, the trial ended with the 9th ballot of the jury awarding Henry Ford 6 cents damages and cost.
1919. That was the year
that you were reading these bestsellers: Java Head by Joseph Hergesheimer, The Brass Check by Upton Sinclair, The Moon and Sixpence by W. Somerset Maugham. That was the year that you were hiding a copy of James Branch Cabell's Jurgen behind a black jacket. That was the year that William Gillette was appearing in J.M. Barrie's play, Dear Brutus. That English John Drinkwater's play of The Life of Abraham Lincoln was thrilling American audiences with Frank McGlynn in the title role. And that was the year that a pseudo-oriental tune filtered into the post-war consciousness of a relieved world, and you sang and danced too.
Legion. By the darned elves with glowing eyes, she looks across the sea and sighs, and weeps her love spells over Rhian. Thank you.